Welcome to the China Desk Podcast, presented by the Federal Newswire, with your host, Steve Yates.
Welcome to the China Desk Podcast. I'm your host, Steve Yates, Senior Research Fellow for China and National Security at the Heritage Foundation. A reminder to our audience, for whom we are most grateful, viewers can watch the China Desk on YouTube or subscribe to hear all our interviews on Apple, Spotify, and most other podcast providers. We welcome you to check out our website and show archive at chinadeskpodcast.com. My guest today is Andrew Phelan, an Australian med tech entrepreneur and writer with a strong background in international affairs, a former DFAT, that's a fancy acronym for Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, the Australia-China Council scholar, and Johns Hopkins Nanjing Center alumni. Well, I went to the Nanjing part of Johns Hopkins SAIS. Happy to connect with Andrew today on multiple fronts. He's lived and worked extensively in China, focusing on cross-cultural engagement and innovation. Today, he combines that expertise with his work in the health technology sector, his insights on U.S.-China relations, global business, and the future of medical innovation. And from time to time, your humble host can catch some media clips of him imparting his wisdom to audiences at home in Australia and abroad. But with that, Andrew, please feel free to revise and extend or correct any of that background information. But otherwise, welcome to the China Desk. Let's jump in.
Good to be with you, Steve.
Well, I shared a bit in the pre-show. We like our audience to get to know our guests as human beings before we start picking their brains on the deep topics of the day. And we have some deep topics with regard to understanding China, but also understanding our country's policies for dealing with China. But Andrew, when you were going up through grade school, did you just know one day you were going to speak Mandarin and try to help the world understand how to navigate Australia-China relations?
Well, I was a curious kid in high school, and I wanted to, you know, Australia's a long way from everywhere. It's a continent in the Southern Hemisphere, and Australians are great travelers. And I dreamed of foreign lands as a kid, you know. So in high school, I wanted to go to Kilimanjaro. I wanted to go to Everest. I've done both of those, by the way. Wow. I haven't climbed, but yeah. I was a kind of adventurous kid. And then my best friend in high school, his elder brother, got posted to Beijing as a China correspondent. And so David went in 86. I decided to learn Mandarin. There was a few Asian languages that I was thinking of. I thought Mandarin made the most sense. At that point, China was just starting to open up, and it could have done a U-turn and closed again. And I thought, well, there's some risk of that. But if that happens, you know, there's always Taiwan. But I thought it was pretty unlikely. I thought once, SEZs, the Special Economic Zones, opened, I thought, you know, when I was a kid in the 70s, all the toys and trinkets were made in Hong Kong. In the 80s, they were made in the four tiger economies. And I thought all that manufacturing, all the toys and all the other stuff, electronics, that's all going to pour into China. And I was right. Of course, it did, of course. I decided to learn Mandarin, and it was an interesting time. The first students from China started coming to Australia in about 86. And I'd see them on a bus, you know, and you could tell they were from mainland China. And I just started learning. So I'd go up and go, ni hao. And then they'd be like, oh, wow, you know, you speak Chinese. You know, you only knew a few words. And then they'd invite you over to their place and, you know, you'd make dumplings. And so for me, when I started the language, it was very much a living, you know, I was speaking it, right? And that's the whole point of the exercise. So, and then I had my first trip to China in 88. Mm-hmm. So that was...
And where did you go when you first went?
Yeah, it was actually my first time overseas. So it was a real eye-opener, to say the least. So I flew from Melbourne by Guangzhou to Beijing. I was in Zhengzhou, went to Kunming, Shanghai, Guilin, Guangzhou, and then down to Hong Kong. And the first thing I did in Hong Kong, of course, was go to a McDonald's.
I have a friend who used to say that they would always stop in Marriott on the way out because they had very good hamburgers, and it was a way to cleanse the palate after a week of different food.
88. When was the first time you went, Steve?
Well, my first visits to China writ large was I was sent to the real China, as I was told, in 1987 as a missionary to Taiwan. So I spent 2 years in Taiwan. And then when I came home, I was recruited nearly immediately into the intelligence services, which had an opinion about whether I should be able to travel. And so I wasn't able to go to China for the first time until after I left the intelligence services in 1996, when I first was employed by the Heritage Foundation. So it was early 1996 that I first went to mainland China.
Right. Yeah. So when I first went there, 88 was the summer of inflation.
Yeah.
The basket of goods, it was more than 30%. So it was a real worry for the government. The three big ticket items, the aspirational items, you know, for the Lees, the Joes, and so on, were a wristwatch, a Shoyin Gia radio, and a Zixingzhou, a push bike.
Yeah.
So they were the aspirational items that people wanted. And it just goes to show how far, you know, life was very simple back then. There were hardly any cars. Everyone was on their bikes. And it just goes to show you how much it's changed and how vast the transformation has been. It's a completely different place.
So you went, were you a student when you went? Had you graduated and this was part of a first job?
Yeah, no, my first trip was just a holiday. My second trip, I was an undergraduate and I had a scholarship. I interned with BHP in their Beijing office, and I went to language school, the Gaoji Guanli Gambushu and the High Level Carter Training Institute. I'm not sure exactly what the High Level Carters did there, but got trained in something or other. But I had Chinese classes there in the morning. In the afternoon, I would go to the BHP office. And back then, China was 2% of BHP's iron ore exports. Japan was the big customer. So China was just starting out, actually. And later on, I had an opportunity to go back there, and silly me, I didn't, because if I'd have, jumped into that business, the iron ore business, I mean, it's the transformation, I would have retired a long time ago. I would have been very successful. But, you know, I went out to Shougang, Capital Iron and Steel Works, which was a, you know, state-run kind of, you know, Stalinist-planned steelworks. It was enormous. 100,000 people, very inefficient. And I met some government officials and so on, but they hardly had any money. Back in those days, they had two kinds of currency. They had the renminbi and they had the Weihuizhuan, or the FEC, they called them.
I remember all that.
Yeah, nominally they were the same, but on the black market, the FEC was about 30% more because you could buy imported things with it, you know. So there's a real shortage of Forex. And later on, if you went to there was a KFC at Tiananmen, just behind Tiananmen Square. There was no McDonald's. And there was a queue for foreigners that they could spend FEC, you know. But, yeah, looking back, it was, China was just starting out. It was so rudimentary. And you think about it, right, from 66 to 76, first 10 years of my life, they had the Cultural Revolution, right?
Yep.
And they were pretty much shut off after Mao's death up until kind of the mid-80s when Deng started the reform and opening up. And I think Deng just said, look, we're poor, we're backward, we need to open up, we need science, we need investment, we need technology. And I think Deng will go down as one of the most significant characters of the 20th century.
Well, for sure, that was a tectonic shift. I think that the one point of analysis that has grown on me over the years is how much of China's explosion in growth had to do with wisdom and strategy from the upper echelons of Communist Party leadership, and how much of it was them saying yes to exorbitantly generous and probably naive Western corporations and multilateral lending organizations that showered finance opportunity and access in. There is wisdom in saying yes when opportunity knocks on your door. And that was I don't know whether the opportunity was knocking at Mao's door, but he sure wasn't saying yes. But Deng at least had the wisdom. He said, you know, when you open the door, some flies can come in. He was willing to risk the flies and take the opportunity. And a billion Chinese people are better for that.
Yeah, he was smart. He was very wise. I mean, having the special economic zones on the coast meant it was kind of trialing reform and opening up rather than doing it right across the country to see how it went. So the change wasn't too drastic. And of course, the FDI, the foreign direct investment, poured in, mostly from Hong Kong and Taiwan in the early stages. But it's interesting. I've got behind me a copy of the book, Beijing Jeep.
Yep.
And great book. That was the first automotive joint venture in China back when Jeep was owned by American Motors. And, you know, it was a difficult joint venture. And within a couple of years, you'd see these sort of Beijing Jeep knockoffs. So, you know, even way back then, there were cars that were, you know, a copy of the Beijing Jeep design. But, yeah, everyone was sort of feeling their way. You know, there wasn't really a managerial class in China because the people that would have been at university during the Cultural Revolution, they were, you know, in the countryside or they were having struggle sessions or what have you. So they didn't really get a university education. So a lot of these people that I encountered were politically savvy, politically, you know, really kind of aggressive, you know. And it's funny, even when China was really poor, there was this sort of sense of ambition and even a little bit of arrogance, you know, the 5,000 years of history, you'd hear that. But there was, I remember there was a T-shirt that was quite popular at the time. And it said in English, "Happy, our country being famous for its rich and strong." You know, and I remember being outside the Great Hall.
Those were the days.
Yeah, yeah. And that building was built in 11 months. And I remember thinking, wow, if these people kind of ever get their act together, look out, you know. So that foreign investment just poured in. And, of course, you know, the Chinese people were hungry to learn, hungry to work hard. You know, they sensed this opportunity, and there was an optimism in the air, this feeling of possibility, and I think that really lasted from that period in the early or to mid 80s up until, you know, around 2010, 2011, and the atmosphere, you know, the economy slowed down. The atmosphere is very different now. Yeah. And in that first decade of the century, there was a lot of optimism. You know, it was relatively free before Xi Jinping took over.
I agree completely with the general opening philosophy that led to a boom that we've hardly ever seen in human history, just transforming the standard of living for the people of China. How much was from the outside, how much was generated inside, whatever it was. There was the terrible Tiananmen Square massacre with sanctions and need for recovery from that. But really, the biding your time and hiding capabilities went pretty much until we met the two words wolf warrior somewhere in the mid-2010s in the Xi Jinping era. But Andrew, from an Australian point of view or your analytical point of view, what do you think was changing that was bringing about that pivot?
I think it was probably before the wolf warrior kind of behavior started. I think the assertiveness, the ditching of hide your time and hide your strength. I think that probably ended around 2008. The ambition was always there, even from the beginning. You know, China's kind of national self-awareness was that it was a great country. I remember I was in a joint venture, an ice cream joint venture, and we had a colleague come up from Thailand. And I explained to my Chinese colleagues that Thailand was more advanced at the time. The retail sector was more advanced. They couldn't believe it. How could that possibly be? You know, Jack Ma, when he came to Australia for the first time, he was always told that, you know, China, you know, had a great living standard, that it was successful. And then he came to Australia and he was like, wow, look at the way these people live here, you know. So there are a lot of people had no idea about the outside world. But I think it was about 2008. Why is that? Well, we had the Beijing Olympics, which was China's coming out party. You know, they bid for the 2000 Olympics, which Sydney got. they weren't ready for it. So they had the Asian Games in 1990, 1 year after Tiananmen. And so in 2008, they did a great job. That was their coming out party. It was also the year of the, we call it the GFC in Australia, the subprime crisis and the financial crisis around the world. And I think that triggered the thought among the Chinese leadership was, hey, you know what? The American system's, you know, it's not perfect. You know, how did that happen? You know, what were the issues in governance to have a disaster the size of the subprime crisis? And so I think, you know, the Chinese leadership felt confident. They felt assertive. You know, they're very strategic. They're very long term, as you know. You know, they play the long game. They take the long view. Of course, they don't have to stand for elections, and they're not, you know, Chinese state-owned enterprises are not worried about making the quarter or their stock price as much as US ones. But 2008, I think, you know, was a shift. And then when Xi Jinping came to power, right from the get-go, he was different to Hu Jintao. He was different to Jiang Zemin. He was far more assertive. And then we had this period of the wolf warrior behavior, which was, you know, let's all the diplomats, they're not really diplomats. They're sort of the CCP's reps around the world. They're hardly diplomatic, but they were given, you know, and they're kept on a very short leash. They're generally given a template from which to speak. But the direction was the wolf warrior behavior, which was basically, let's be obnoxious as possible and you know, insulting and obnoxious. And that went on for quite a while, and then it was toned down. It didn't win Beijing any favors. And then, of course, you know, we ended up in the COVID period, which was a difficult time in China's foreign relations as well.
Well, for sure, I would kind of flag trade and economics as one of the first tripwires in the U.S.-China change. That is kind of coincident with a loss of faith in globalism generally, institutions like the World Trade Organization, but the notion that we didn't get a fair deal economically really hit both major political parties in the United States in 2016 and going forward. The COVID experience, I think, was profound, and I think we're still trying to kind of unpack what the reaction to that is, because there was a really strong domestic reaction in the United States that was party to party, you know, kind of left versus right, in some ways a Rorschach test. But there is still pretty strong residual that, you know, China did this. And then for the United States in particular, but not only the United States, there's also fentanyl, and there was the odd spy balloon and other, you know, we have viruses that people are trying to smuggle into research laboratories and other oddities that kind of fill out the Christmas tree of grievances that have kind of changed the mood in the United States. Help our audience fill in some of the blanks of how this story is the same or has been filling in Australia while it's all these things have been changing perceptions in the US.
Just before I do that, Steve, I think it's worth evaluating where we are now. Okay, yeah. So, you know, in the early thousands, things were pretty good. You know, the U.S. automakers GM was manufacturing in China. They made a Buick in China. It was doing very well. They made a lot of money, and now they're losing money. So things were good up until recent years. And so there's been this big trend of, I remember in 2004, there was a cover of Business Week, and it was a three-word title, and the title was The China Price, The China Price. And the article was all about US manufacturers, you know, mostly in the Midwest and so on, that were getting outbid by Chinese competitors that were, you know, quoting 30% cheaper. So, you know, what had happened was, you know, we're all trying to, you know, increase profits. So we offshored manufacturing to China at lower wages. That was good for corporate profits. It was good for Wall Street. It wasn't so good for Main Street. It wasn't so good for manufacturing. But you know, there was this tide, and it was the way to go. That's worked really well up until now. It's worked well until it's not going well. And so there's been this symbiotic relationship of offshoring manufacturing, and you've got two very different systems. You know, a lot of corporations in China are SOE, state-owned enterprises, and even the private ones, the state is quite involved. But certainly the SOEs, you know, they get preferential financing from state-owned banks. You know, they operate very differently. And China, of course, doesn't have an independent judiciary. So, you know, Michael Jordan sued a Chinese manufacturer for patent infringement, and he won. It took a very long time. But that stuff is pretty much unheard of. And I think what happened also was when China joined the WTO and Bill Clinton said, this is great, you know, they're going to liberalize, we're bringing them into the world order, et cetera, you know, we stopped doing the most favored nation review every year. They got into the WTO. They wanted to get into the WTO. And, you know, they haven't abided by the rules. And we've kind of put up with that. We've let that go. But we got to the point now where the hollowing out of the US industrial base is a huge problem. And I think what's happening now, I think what President Trump is doing is saying, excuse me, enough's enough. We have to bring some of this stuff back. We have to have critical industries. We have to have a steel industry. We need to, you know, start building ships again and this sort of stuff. And I think, you know, the realization has been late at the 11th hour, but it's better late than never. So, you know, the system, my point is the system that we've had in the last 30 years, it's over, it's finished. So there's a what I call a great bifurcation, you know, and, it, you know, it's things like rare earth minerals and stuff like that. But it's going to be a whole bunch of stuff, a whole bunch of products, you know, stuff moving out of China into Vietnam and India and so on, but also reshoring. The last 30-year period, it was a symbiotic relationship. It was great while it lasted. It's over. And if we think, you know, the Beijing's always talking, Xi Jinping's always talking about free trade and, you know, open economies and and you know, rules-based trading system, that's rubbish. It's very difficult to get products into China. You know, when I was working for GE, if you wanted to get a finished product, a medical product into China, the SFDA, their version of the FDA, would try and get, you know, basically the blueprints of the product so that a local manufacturer could copy it. You know, they invited companies in the auto industry. It was mandatory to do a joint venture, and it was mandatory to do tech transfer. So, you know, they invited these companies in, they were skilling up, training, and waiting for the day when these companies would go back to their home country with their tail between their legs. And we see that story time and time and time again. The Wuhan lab, for example, was initially a Sino-French joint venture. Jacques Chirac cut the ribbon when that opened. You know, France is pretty strong in that space. You know, Pasteur, Sanofi, Adventist, and so on. And once the Chinese had got, you know, the level of skill and knowledge that they wanted, you know, the French went home with their tail between their legs. It happens all the time. So when we talk about decoupling from China, they've been decoupling from the US and from the West and the US, you know, for the last 20 odd years. They even have a name for it. They call it Delete America. So, you know, when they launched Made in China 2025 back in 2015, they said, okay, these are strategic areas that we want to focus in. We want to go up in terms of technology. And they've achieved probably 80% of Made in China 2025. But yeah, they want to effectively cut. They don't want to buy stuff from America. I mean, if they could make planes as good as Boeing, they'd stop buying from Boeing. And they're trying to do that with COMAC. You know, they're not there yet, but you know that's the idea. And at the same time, they're making 2x what they can absorb locally. So we're in this new kind of phenomenon of the China Shock 2, which is tech products and EVs. I mean, Australia's flooded with Chinese EVs. And petrol cars, but also EVs. There's no tariff here. There was no security review, unlike in the US. And they're showing up in Thailand and Indonesia and Brazil. And manufacturers in those countries are taking a beating because nobody can compete against the size and scale of China's manufacturing. So yeah, it's time to say stop. It's time to push back. It's time we got our own house in order in terms of manufacturing. So it's a really, it's really the end of an era.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned the, delete America concept too, because I don't think that gets talked about very much.
Yeah, well, people in the US should understand this stuff, and they should also understand how ruthless the CCP is. You know, I mean, in the public commentary, Xi Jinping lies all the time, you know, talking about win-win cooperation and, you know, mutual respect for small countries. I mean, China's trying to displace the US. It wants to be, you know, the kind of central, most important economy in the world. It wants to have a bunch of rules, you know, Xi Jinping's security initiative, his culture initiative, and these sorts of things. And you know, he's trying to recruit as many countries in the global south as he can, and he's also trying to export, you know, through Huawei and other companies, the same sort of surveillance and censorship infrastructure that he's got in China. Back to Australia, Australia's done very well out of China's rise, better than any other country actually. There's a high degree of complementarity between the two economies. We're a big commodities exporter. You know, mining is a big industry here. Some of the biggest mining companies in the world are here. There's a great deal of expertise. So Australia's been exporting iron ore and coal and other commodities to China for a long time. It's really underwritten our prosperity in the last 20 or 30 years. Because if you think about the size and scale of China's transformation and manufacturing, it's been fueled largely by Australian coal and iron ore. So when our Prime Minister pushed back on COVID and said, well, we really need an international inquiry with proper powers to get to the bottom of the origin of COVID, China wasn't happy. Their expectation was that because Australia had done well, we have a current account surplus with China, one of few countries that do, that we should be grateful and we should be obedient and we should not challenge Beijing. And of course, the Prime Minister said, you know, we should have an inquiry. I was working in the infection control space between two US companies. I was working for a Swedish company, and we'd had SARS, we'd had MERS. So we had a degree of familiarity with these type of events in the region. In fact, Singapore, where I was based at the time, they had a system, they called it the DORSCON system, Disease Outbreak Response System. That was well in place before COVID. But in 2003, when we had SARS, China was actually more open. Yeah. And CDC people came in and that sort of thing. Xi Jinping, he censored the doctors. He locked down Wuhan, but he allowed, in the immediate period after the virus started to spread, he allowed people to go to Lunar New Year functions, and that spread the virus. And then he allowed people to leave Wuhan and travel internationally. At the same time, he was, you know, getting their hands on as much PPE from around the world as they could, often via ethnic Chinese communities around the world, while lying about the pandemic. So, I mean, it seems everybody's forgotten that. But, yeah. You know, the fact of the matter is, and this went right up to Xi Jinping, it was a cover-up. He lied about it, and he let the virus effectively get on planes and fly around the world. And it's out, when you think about it, it's absolutely outrageous, you know. So
it's hard to imagine another example in human history of anything that comes remotely close to this scale and people don't change the nature of their relations or interaction in any meaningful way.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's, you know, if there was a new another virus or communicable disease that started in China today, it would still be very difficult to cooperate with the government. It wasn't the case in around 2003. China was more open and more pragmatic. But I think Xi Jinping, he's very anti-American, and he's very, you know, we can do it ourselves. We don't need the West. You know, the Western firms were the first to produce vaccines. You know, the fact is that they're more advanced in that space than China is, and China's vaccines were less efficacious than the Western ones. But then there was this narrative, because, of course, the Communist Party is always correct, right? They're never wrong. And they're correct. They're never wrong. So you can't admit to being wrong. So, you know, they went through this period with the Wolf Warrior thing, and they were saying around the world, look, we've locked down. The virus hasn't spread. So there was chaos in the US at the time. Look at us. You know, our model's better than yours once again. And, of course, when they finished the lockdown, they made the decision on a Sunday. They didn't tell any of the hospitals. So on Monday, all the hospitals are having to deal with all these elderly people catching the virus. God knows how many people died, elderly people died, as the virus ripped through China at the end of lockdowns. The Wolf Warrior thing, Australia, we got put in the sin bin. Yeah. You know, we got a big yellow card. So it started with coal. Our coal exports were sitting on ships offshore in China. They wouldn't let us unload. They did a deal with the Indonesians. Then it started on a bunch of other things as well. You know, barley, you know, crayfish or lobsters, beef, all these other things. And the Chinese said, you know, these bans were because of technical issues or whatever. In fact, they were unilateral trade coercion and punishment, because the Australian government had the temerity to ask for an independent inquiry into COVID. So in terms of being a global citizen, in terms of being an alternative to the US-led rules-based order, I mean, if that's an example of what China's going to do, I wouldn't be in a rush to sign up to that.
No. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the personal experiences, because one of the things that I think that has changed fundamentally and made more people aware in America, but I think also in Australia and other places, is the willingness of United Front or other arms of the CCP to bring harassment and surveillance and in some ways conflict into other countries. Now, it can start off with crazy rich Chinese citizens showing up and hot rodding in their Ferraris around your town to show who the boss is. But they can also go find dissidents and put fear in them. And sometimes they go after people who are not ethnically Chinese. But talk a little bit about what your experience has been in watching what we might call the transnational repression arm of the CCP as it's reached into Australia.
Yeah, we had a case a few weeks ago, Steve, in Sydney. A 23-year-old Chinese national called Yang Lan Lan crashed her Rolls Royce at 3 a.m. on a weekend, refused to do a breath test and so on. She's got two Rolls Royces, so the one that's...
As one does.
Yeah. The guy that she ran into is very badly injured, actually. But apparently she's... somebody's granddaughter. You know, she's related to red royalty, as they call it. Socialism with Chinese characteristics, you know, 23-year-old with a Rolls Royce in Sydney. We had Xi Jinping's brother-in-law was a high roller at Crown Casino in Melbourne too, and dropped more than $20 million. So, you know, but you're not allowed to talk about the net worth of the red royal families. The United Front, most people here have never heard of it. And so I'm doing some work with some of the political parties here and Professor John Fitzgerald, who's an expert on the Chinese diaspora, to better educate politicians here. When I came back to Australia, I came back because of my aging parents. I was based in Singapore for 15 years before I came back here. I was appalled by the lack of substantive coverage of China and Asia in the mainstream media. So I decided to do something about it. Now, I tapped into experts in my network, people like Bill Hayton, who wrote South China Sea, Invention of China, people like Nadezhda Roland.
Invention of China, I think, is one of the most important books that I want more people to read.
It's a very important book. Nadezhda Roland on Belt and Road, Andrew Erickson on the People's Liberation Army Navy. I tapped some of these people to come on National News here, ABC News in Australia. And then at one point, somebody asked me to go on air one day, and I got a kick out of it, you know, live TV. I love talking about this stuff. Anyone that knows me knows that the geopolitics and, you know, great power competition has been my thing for a very long period of time, even though I wasn't, you know, an academic or a political scientist. I was working for medical technology corporations. So I went on and then I got asked again, and one thing led to another, and I've been doing it for 3 or 4 years now, because, you know, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to get journalists into China. They can't get a visa. And the business model was, you know, you'd have journalists that would get the China posting for 3 years with no Chinese. Now, that's unacceptable in this day and age. And by the time their term has finished, they're just starting to figure the place out. So me, I'm a lifer. So yeah. I'm going to be reading and studying and talking about this stuff forever, because I find it fascinating. And, you know, I'm interested in what makes countries tick. Why was Japan successful after World War II? Why have Southeast Asian countries not been, and so on? You know, good governance, corruption, all those sorts of issues. So I decided to talk, and then the penny dropped for me in about 2011. And I started to, in my commentary, I was quite direct, I was quite critical. And there were three things that made me speak. One was the militarization of islands and reefs in the South China Sea. When I saw that, I thought, okay, China's clearly got extraterritorial imperial ambitions. You know, they want to be they want to throw their weight around. So that was very clear to me. The second thing was, you know, in the late 90s, I visited Auschwitz-Birkenau, and it's a pretty numbing experience. And at the end of the day, I said to myself, why did I come here? What was the point of the exercise? Well, the point of the exercise is, if you see this sort of phenomenon, this sort of behavior happening on your watch, right, not 70 or 80 years ago, but in your life, it's in your in-tray, you're going to speak up. You're going to speak up about it, because that sort of thing, I don't want, you know, that's unacceptable. So when China started putting Uyghurs, incarcerating Uyghurs at scale in a very systematic fashion, industrial fashion, as it were, I thought, that's not cool. I don't like that. I don't like a minority or religious group, cultural group, you know, being treated like that. And, you know, the re-education camps and all that. That was another reason. And then the third reason was they started interfering in my country. So, you know, foreign interference. Now, when you're traveling around the world, or I'm in China, you know, it's not up to me to tell them how to run their country. I'm a guest or a visitor in somebody else's country. But when they start interfering, you know, clandestinely in my country, I got a problem with that. You know, the US and Australia have been allies for over 100 years, and a lot of men and women went into war, went into battle, and lost their lives. You know, they made the ultimate sacrifice for the freedoms that we enjoy today and take for granted. And so I started talking about this. They were the three things. And so I got noticed. I guess, you know, the embassy would have people monitoring various media. And I started, you know, getting a bit of a reputation for myself. There was very few people that were as assertive in their criticisms as I was. And I think that's for a number of reasons. One, the academics, you know, being tied with the university, there's so much revenue from Chinese students. They're reluctant to talk about this stuff. When I was in corporate life, I remember at GE, we just sold the 787 avionics to COMAC, the Chinese state-owned plane maker. I thought it was crazy. But if I'd have said so publicly, you know, out loud, I would have lost my job. So you've got to self-censor if your company's got operations in China. And, you know, speaking uncensored, speaking, being free to speak, it's very liberating. It's a good feeling. Just telling the truth and talking about these things. So I started doing that. You know, at the time of the pandemic, the embassy was very sensitive about the narrative. Xiao Chen, who's the CCP chief rep in Canberra, went to the ABC, the national broadcaster, and said, you know, tell China's story well. They want positive news. They don't want criticism. And so, you know, he held a reception in the embassy, and, you know, said, we've done a great job in China with COVID. You know, we're going to cease these trade bans. Things are looking up. You know, I went on air the next day and said, you know, basically countered that narrative with what was actually going on. So I was unpopular with the embassy. And then I was a victim of a foreign interference attack. And it's the same thing that happened to Representative Molinar at the Committee on the CCP. In a fake email was created in his name, and these emails were sent out. That's what happened to me, and it couldn't have come at a worse time. I downed tools and put my career on hold to take care of my terminally ill mother. And this was on January 24, 2023. I'd had a guy coming to install a hospital bed, and I had a tradesman coming. So I was expecting people. I went to open the door, and there were four Victoria, that's my local state, police. And they said, are you Andrew Phelan? I said, yeah. They didn't say, can I come in? They burst in. I took my computers, and one guy pulled out an arrest warrant and search warrant and said, you're under arrest for threatening to kill somebody. And, you know, I was looking after my terminally ill mother at the time, and I'd barely left the local area. And it was a surreal moment, like, what? What's going on, you know? And they mentioned the name of the complainant. She had a Chinese surname. I'd never met her. I'd never heard of her. But that was my first clue. And when I was down at the police station, the penny dropped that this is what they did to Drew Pavlou, who's a young activist student who I know well, a very bright young guy. He was arrested outside the PRC embassy in London for supposedly sending them an email threatening to bomb the embassy. When I heard about that, I burst out laughing because Drew would be late for his own funeral, let alone bomb an embassy, you know. Just outrageous stuff. But he was arrested, and he was handcuffed, and he was held overnight, and it's a 10-year sentence, and he was 23 or something at the time. He was terrified, you know. And, you know, the police came back a couple of days later. Mum was home, and she was in the hospital bed, and I said, come on in. And I think they were very, very embarrassed by it. But our federal police, you know, they've sort of fallen for the newest trick in the book, and they're not terribly well educated and trained in this stuff. So that's an area where we need to do better to understand the modus operandi of the CCP, whether it's hacking, whether it's these sort of impersonation attacks and so on. The United Front, the way they operate with the diaspora, you know, we've seen the cases in New York City, New York State, in terms of interfering with elections. People need to understand that. There's a guy called Michael Lucci, who I'm sure you've heard of, in Texas, who has a company called State Armor. He's going around the country in the US trying to educate at a state legislature level and trying to bring in new laws, for example, to keep PRC entities out of the grid, to prevent farmland being sold near military bases and all that sort of stuff. The conversation here, under Malcolm Turnbull as Prime Minister in about 2016, we were the first country to ban Huawei, which was a good move. And then they introduced the foreign interference legislation. There's been three cases. One guy's in jail. There's another case right now in Canberra. And so that's going to get a lot of attention, spying and interference, particularly through the diaspora. And I think one of the things is since, you know, the iPhone came out in 2008, we've now got all these, a Chinese person can come and live in America or Australia and live in a digital ecosystem that's entirely created in China. The servers are in China, it's censored and controlled from China. And I think that's an issue as well. You know, a lot of, most Chinese Australians love it here. They love the freedom, and that's why they came here. But there are elements that do Beijing's bidding here in Australia and in the US, and we need to talk about that. We need to talk about it. We need to understand how the United Front works. We need to educate, and these people need to be, you know, if they're found engaging in foreign interference, they need to be charged and they need to be jailed or deported.
Yeah. Well, it is something that has gone on for a very, very long time, but it's been more widespread and more in the open, I think, in recent years. And I thank you for sharing the anecdote of your family, because personally, I don't think it was by accident in terms of the timing and impact of what they were doing. And it's not just sort of political warfare that you'd think of by just spinning rhetoric and you know, trying to name and shame people. They methodically are looking for points of opportunity and weakness and using our systems against us. So getting your police force to do what they did is a win for them. And they similarly will try to get university leadership to do things to their own students, get corporate leaders to do things to their own employees. But getting us to do our own undermining or using the systems to punish those engaged in wrong think and wrong speak, that's the Cultural Revolution 2.0 that is going out there.
Whether it's Daryl Morey at the Houston Rockets or whatever, people should be able to speak their mind freely on these things without, you know, the corporation or the government or the university telling them to pull their head in. And it's happened a lot. It's happened in the UK. Yeah. It happens here. And we need to push back against it.
We do. We do. Well, Andrew, I knew at the outset of this conversation that we would have an endless list of topics that we would want to talk about. And I sure hope you'll agree to come back for another episode to continue the conversation. I think there's some very, very important themes that you were able to share, the context of the early days, how things had changed. I think you had some really interesting insights about when some of these turning points were that I don't think have often been shared in our space. And I think I've always looked at you in recent years as one of the reliable voices talking about the new realities we face, that many of us who went into this journey went in good faith, believed in engagement, and we were mugged by reality along the way. And we are somewhat reluctant warriors in this, but nonetheless, when a war has been declared on you, your choice is whether and how to react. You don't get to wish it away. And so that's the way I think about it. And I think we'll have much, much more to talk about in the future if you're kind enough to come back. But in the meantime, where would you urge people to go to follow the wit and wisdom of Andrew Phelan, or otherwise follow your media or other commentary?
So you follow my X account, which is at AJPHELO, AJ Phelo. I'm doing more and more media here. I'm also doing quite a bit of public speaking, not so much at the universities, but debates, veterans associations, you know, rugby and football clubs. I'll speak to anybody that's interested. And because of the restraints of the media, I'll just go out and talk to people. I love talking about this stuff. And the response, I've done five of them this year, the response has been overwhelming. People come up to me and they say, we didn't know this stuff. How come this stuff's so important. How come we didn't know it? Well, if you're depending on legacy media for it, you're not going to get it. I mean, I read an enormous amount. I'm always learning new stuff, but I can match that to my own personal firsthand experience in the trenches of commerce in these markets and in China, and hopefully make sense of it from a very practical point of view. A lot of the academics and journalists don't have that background.
Well, you certainly let the China Desk audience in on some of your insights and perspectives. I find it of value, and I hope they do too. To our audience, if you've enjoyed today's conversation on the China Desk, please tell your friends, consider subscribing, and visit thechinadeskpodcast.com. Thank you very much for joining. A special thank you to Andrew Phelan for sharing his perspectives. Until next time, I'm Steve Yates, your host here at the China Desk.
Thank you for listening to the China Desk Podcast, presented by the Federal Newswire and hosted by Steve Yates. Check out the Federal Newswire's family of websites, as well as their social media streams.